Well, before we start our talk this morning, there's a little confusion in the program, which I'd like to call to your attention. On May 17th, which is a week from today, John Irwin is listed to speak. But it's not possible for him to keep that appointment, so I'm taking that Sunday. I'll be here with you again next Sunday, and I will give the talk that was intended for June 21st, the Chinese astrology, the year of the rooster. So that will be the subject for next Sunday, and John Irwin will be speaking on the date that I've given up in June. That makes it all very clear, I'm sure. In other words, we hope to see you next week. The subject of the morning is really a very difficult one to approach in a factual manner. We all realize, I think, that there are a great many things that are true, but which can get people into trouble. We are not doubting or questioning the existence of psychic phenomena. We are not doubting the existence of nuclear research, but we don't like some of the things that happen as a result of it. We are not opposed to television, but we think some of the programs are pretty terrible. We think people should write good books, but we do not like all the books that they seem to write. So that while there are truths and facts and realities which probably in a dignified, scientific, and thoughtful manner could be very constructive, but once they hit the media, once they are popularized and dramatized, they have a tendency to cause trouble. And this is especially true, I think, in the field of psychic phenomena. For many years, this was quite a problem, back in the 20s and early 30s. Then it faded away and was very seldom heard from until the last 4 or 5 years, when I suppose I have more requests to try to untangle people involved in psychic phenomena, more for such requests than all other types of requests that come to me. People are getting into trouble every day. They do not know what to do or how to do it. They are confused, bewildered, and many of them are sick. And this is largely due to a simple fact that Carl Jung pointed out a number of years ago, that the average human being cannot live in a healthy manner in the midst of a mystery. We cannot handle mystery. The moment the common, ordinary facts of life become confused, when we are confronted with situations that we cannot examine and cannot evaluate in terms of personal experience, we are in danger of a bad mental state of confusion. Psychic phenomena today is coming to us through an extensive literature, much of which is avowedly fictional. Some case histories are included. It is being presented and dramatized as a means of creating horror pictures, mystery pictures, and almost anything that will excite a jaded viewer. These types of presentations are not just entertainment. The individual is not able to distinguish clearly between what he sees and the facts of his own daily life. And in addition to this, we have a large group of dabblers in the subject. Individuals who have very little solid foundation upon which to build. They lack the discrimination, they lack the information, and they simply lack a perspective on the subject of metaphysical phenomena. This being true, they are in trouble. And one of the most difficult problems to work with in this type of trouble is psychic phenomena. If the individual is exposed to some phenomenal incident or circumstance which is outside of the experience of his common living, he has a strong tendency to be demoralized. He becomes what might be termed an easy believer. His believing will go to almost any lengths if it is supported by a miracle. Now, miracles are not too common, but various degrees of psychic phenomena are relatively common. They occur almost every day. They are written up in various publications, and at this time some definitely distinguished scholars are working in this area. And one very strong point that has always been present in this area, and one that has basically probably been very beneficial, and that is that it was the beginning of the realization of survival of consciousness after death. Many persons who could not believe it under normal conditions accepted it when it was backed by psychic phenomena. If this phenomena is genuine, it helps to break down the materialistic barrier to the concept of life after death. Thomas Edison was converted to this concept, and at the time of his death was working to try to create a scientific device by means of which it would be possible to communicate with the dead. Two world wars influenced this situation considerably. Sir Oliver Lodge, Arthur Conan Doyle, many others after World War I wrote on the subject of psychic phenomena. Not only as parents and as concerned human beings, but to some measure as well-trained scientists. So the field has always been of great interest. Psychic phenomena is one of the oldest forms of religious belief. Spiritism, as it was originally called, is traceable in the background of practically every human culture. It goes back to the dawn of history and beyond. It has contributed to almost every form of cultural development. It has also, rather consistently, been on the ragged edge of being dangerous. Pythagoras admitted it, but warned against the development of it. This was true of a good many other scholars. We know that it is given a severe reprimand in the Old Testament, and it is considered in most cultures as a dangerous, mysterious thing. Now, why do we consider it dangerous, and why is it so mysterious? I think we have to divide psychic phenomena into two general classifications, genuine and fraudulent. Genuine psychic phenomena certainly exists, but nearly every form of psychic manifestation has been duplicated fraudulently. And for many years, there were companies in this country that manufactured pseudo-psychic phenomena. They created instruments for slate writing. They were able to make a very substantial fabrication of trumpet speaking. Levitation. All these things have been fraudulently produced. This has resulted in the realization that if people would believe or could believe the fraudulent phenomena, then those who are able to put on such an exhibition had new and greater influence in the lives of innocent individuals who believed they were in the presence of a genuine psychic mystery. So the field is burdened with this. It is also burdened by a common fact of human nature, namely that even the most gifted psychic or medium cannot produce phenomena on demand. The individual cannot guarantee the appearance of genuine phenomena just simply because someone comes in and asks for it, or a group of people gather to see it. Therefore, nearly all phenomena has had to be, to a measure, supported by psychological or other forms of instruction. The individual has had to supplement phenomena with other means of influencing the minds of persons he wished to influence. This gradually got more or less out of hand and has been for a long time a very serious handicap to the development of the genuine faculties of man's extrasensory perception range. Now, some types of psychic phenomena are more commonly fabricated than others. Some types are so personal, so intimate, so tied to the individual himself, that there are no elements of probability that they could be fabricated. One of these, for instance, is psychometry, in which the individual himself has the experience of finding certain memories, thoughts, or reconstructions of previous incidents as a result of his own nature. Wherever psychic phenomena comes from within the individual himself and is more or less guaranteed by the fact that no medium or professional person interposes between the psychic and his phenomena, we have fairly substantial grounds for the belief that it is genuine. We also realize that we are coming closer and closer to the development of our own extrasensory perception gamut. More and more, we are having experiences of the development of faculties that have been latent. Among the various systems of the development of such faculties are some that deal very closely with psychic phenomena. The religious and philosophic aspects of this search for inner guidance will be found principally in Oriental religious systems or Christian mysticism. The mystical experience is not inclined to create too much problem or does not contribute to most of the difficulties with which we are confronted. Now, the next important point I think we have to make is to analyze and study the individual who becomes involved in psychic phenomena. The average person who is involved is a lonely, more or less introverted individual who has some earnest desire either to communicate with the dead because of bereavement or to gain some type of experience of life after death as a support to a religious conviction. This type of person is, for the most part, an easy believer. They are looking and desiring so desperately and definitely that they do not generally use a great deal of critical thoughtfulness in the matter. They want to believe in psychic phenomena. They want it because they need it to fill an emptiness in themselves. They feel deserted, lonely, isolated, or frustrated, and hope that in some way the psychic situation will assist to remedy this condition. Because of the fact there is very little basic experience, very little critical knowledge, these persons can be very easily deceived. Also, there is a whole group of psychic phenomena in which there is no intentional to deceive at all, where a mystical experience, a dream, a nightmare, or some subconscious reflex within the person has caused them to assume that they are in the presence of a spiritual reality. Many persons have built philosophies, systems, creeds, and cults upon a dream. A dream which, were they not believers, would have meant nothing to them. But because they were not only believers, but constantly hopeful, things they had read, things that had been told to them, longings and yearnings of their own, affected the sleep state, resulting in what appeared to be a psychic experience. Now, a psychic experience of this kind is clearly not to be considered archetypal. An archetypal dream is not the kind that generally produces this form of phenomena. An archetypal dream is something from within the individual that is demanding recognition. It is an instructional factor. It is the internal teacher being heard from. But a great deal of this psychic phenomena arises from hallucination. It arises from the individual whose desperate desire to believe permits him to believe that which is not reasonable, not probable, and not consistent with his own good. This we find so very, very common. Another difficulty with the matter is that once the believer has gotten into a psychic difficulty, it is extremely difficult to rescue him. The psychic experience which he believes to have occurred is stronger than any counseling that can be given to him. Once he has decided that he is in the presence of a spiritual experience, there's very, very little chance that you can talk him out of it, even when it becomes obvious to a third person that the experience is not genuine. We have all the time this type of problem coming in, people wanting help in these various fields. But it is practically useless to try unless the individual involved is willing to try his own experience for himself. Unless he is willing to sit down and answer some basic questions and answer them honestly, there is very little that anyone on the outside can do that will overcome the desire, the devout intention to believe this particular type of thing. So you can always say to yourself, if you're involved in psychic phenomena, you can ask yourself a few vital questions. One of the most common types of psychic experience is the one that calls the individual to a ministry. It is one in which something, usually the subconscious, seeking release, seeking the experience of self-superiority, likes to hope or feel or believe that they are called to change the course of history, that they have a message that has been given to them that the world is waiting for. Now, the question that you ask these people frequently is, why, if you feel this way, do you believe that you are peculiarly qualified to receive this message? What made you the candidate for this overwhelming revelation? How did it happen that they picked on you? And now, normally, the individual has no very good answer to that question. The most common answer is, I haven't the slightest idea. So you start to try to find out, and you say to yourself, if you were hiring someone to carry on a special and delicate and difficult task, how would you choose to engage that particular person? Well, you'd ask questions, you'd get a resume, you'd find out what they'd done. You try to locate something in them by which they were peculiarly fitted to do the thing that you needed done. Well, we may assume that some powers on the other side of life, selecting a candidate for a delicate job, would also explore into the capacities of that person. They would choose someone who could do the work, who had a background for it, who was well integrated personally, and could carry this responsibility with dignity, whose integrity was so great they would not exploit or commercialize it, and would not be led astray by various temptations involved in this type of labor. But you ask the person these questions, and you seldom, if ever, get a decent answer. The thing is, they just don't know. They believe that they have been chosen, but they do not know why. And when an individual has this particular problem, a very interesting thing comes along. I've had many people come to me and say, I have been selected for a very important work. Well, so what is it? I don't know. I have had a message. I can't read it. Perhaps you can tell me what I'm supposed to be doing. Now, it's difficult to imagine that a person would receive some kind of a serious job and not know why or how or what to do after they had it. And gradually it becomes more or less evident that the situation is bound to wishful thinking, a desperate desire to find some outlet, some way of attaining a kind of distinction in society. There are many types of this problem that come along as the days pass. And one of the other important factors we all have to bear in mind is that the person interested in this type of phenomena, usually, it was sometime along the way, comes under the influence of group activities. Somewhere along the line, there is someone who is specializing, or believes they are, in this type of research. And there is a constant tendency of people of this type to want to get further development, to get further strengthening of their extrasensory perceptions through some type of personal discipline or instruction. This gets to be very complicated, however, unfortunately, because in many instances the blind lead the blind and everything goes bad. In other instances, we find the individual presented with a type of mystery in the group with which he associates himself, which is not very healthy. Not long ago, we received a letter requesting information. This person wanted to join a group that they felt might have the kind of answer that they were seeking. But in order to join this group, they had to take an obligation. They had to take a vow that they would give complete, unquestioning obedience to the leaders of that group. Whatever the leader asked them to do, that they would do without question or hesitation. Well, I would be very much inclined to depart from that group or never get into it. In the next place, in the same point of view, the information was not available as to who was the head of the group. So you were taking a blind obligation of total obedience to persons you have never known, never heard of, and have no way of estimating. When you get a situation of this kind, I think the wise person is best invited to refrain from accepting such an obligation system. The individual's only primary obligation is to God. And next to that, his own integrity. He has certain social obligations to his nation, to his family, to his society. And to compromise these with some kind of an obligation which we are not able to understand, requesting that we take upon ourselves the complete servitude to an unknown person, is not in line with true esoteric good taste or safety. It is a very dangerous thing. Also, we find very often the rising tide of commercialism coming into this problem. The formation of groups, the writing of books, the production of television or theatrical plays for business reasons, for profit, and as far as that's concerned, simply to cater to a market is not a good way for the mysteries of life to be promulgated. It is much too dangerous. I have read a number of the recent books dealing with these subjects. One or two have been very well written and carefully written. For the most part, the others are simply paperback fantasy. They are written only for one purpose, and that is to sell and make money. And these are taken seriously by persons who are already sold to the idea that such procedures are possible. If a person is interested in becoming a member of some mystically oriented organization, it is up to them, for their own security and safety, to make a thorough investigation of the background and foreground of such a group. It is very unwise to join something which the beginnings of which are unknown, the purposes of which are indefinite, and the future of which is uncertain. Therefore, for all general purposes, we give the same general recommendation that we give in connection with reading or study or anything of that nature. It is important that the things you believe have stood the test of time. It is essential that you associate with an organization or group which has stood for principles and the history and development of which is available to the public as common knowledge. An organization that has had a long and distinguished history and has not been in trouble and has never commercialized unreasonably any part of its tradition gives you a certain sense of confidence. And more still, if it is rooted and founded in one of the great world systems of spiritual revelation, it is very much more likely to be legitimate. If, therefore, its background is reasonable, it makes no pretensions or claims, it promises nothing except the opportunity to study, to grow, and to develop normally, this type of organization can be approached with greater safety and greater sense of security and probability. But wherever we get into the weird and the wonderful, we are apt to be in trouble. It's just not the best way to do this type of thing. Another point that I think is very important is authority. When a special revelation comes along, who is responsible for it? Nearly always, you have one of two choices. Either that the system has been developed by an individual who takes full responsibility for it and who has probably based it upon older source material which he is willing to discuss, describe, and state. It is also probable that he can prove reasonably to the average person that his ideas have common sense, practical value, and do not stimulate unreasonable emotions or attitudes. This type of person is comparatively safe, as Confucius pointed out, and many of the older ones. Confucius said, "Well, you have an idea, don't quote yourself." He said, "It is much better for you to find an appropriate quotation among the sages, those who have been wise and learned and helpful to mankind. If you wish to make a statement, always back it up by some legitimate person who has proven in daily life that they knew more than the average, and that this knowledge has endured and been supported and substantiated by centuries of application, then you're reasonably safe. But be extremely cautious with books that are written by unknown beings, persons from other planets, or persons that have no relationship to common life. Be very cautious of accepting an authority that you cannot check. And if the time comes and you want to know where the message comes from, and you are given some very fantastic explanation that you can never verify, then it seems that you should approach with caution. Out of the same sequence as this comes the problem of what happens when we begin to try to accept these different things. Supposing good-naturedly, consecratedly, and with faith and solid belief, we follow one of these systems. We go in and we listen to the way they tell us it should be done. They have a development program. They have ways of helping you to become wiser. They also may toss in a few promises of advanced finances and real estate. So, believing in them and taking the disciplines, doctrines, exercises, meditations, and so forth, which they recommend, what happens? Are you able to retain your common sense well enough to watch the results of these things upon your own personal life? Do you find at the end of 6 months or a year that you are really a better person? That you have grown, that your family life is closer, that you understand your children better, that you are a better citizen, that you are inspired to genuine self-improvement through self-discipline and the control of negative habits and attitudes? Are you growing, or are you simply being filled with a mass of abstract thought which you cannot apply to anything, or have never thought of trying to apply? Are you growing, or are you simply remembering a group of material factors which may or may not ever prove to be true? If at the end of a few months of this special discipline you're beginning to feel miserable, your appetite gets bad, your sleep is disturbed, you are seeing things that are not there, and you are more or less involved in strange feelings, experiences, that you have very strange dreams, that you develop certain factors or attitudes which appear to be semi-clairvoyant, but have very little utility in them. It's like the individual who was able to study the other planes of nature by extrasensory perception, but was unable to find a lost cufflink in his own bureau drawer. He worked on it hard, but it was much easier to see things that weren't there than find something that was lost here. So we have to think about this. Most of the people who come in trouble are troubled by the consequences of the methods that they have been given for self-development purposes. One of the most common of these causes, of course, is that they have been given the impression that these exercises or this membership or this allotment is going to make it unnecessary for them to become basically better people. It is going to be done with a formula. It is going to be done that by a method that can be given to the good, the bad, and the indifferent, and it will work for all of them because it's the formula that is important. And this formula is the direct route to enlightenment. The answer to this is nearly always the same: misery, disillusionment. So the individual finally comes to the fact that he has supported his own gullibility with a mass of psychic phenomena. He has, for instance, spent years studying the constructions of some psychic situation which he will never see, never know, and never realize whether he's right or wrong. But he memorizes it all. He memorizes a series of wonders. He follows a series of beliefs that he cannot justify except by blind acceptance. He also develops gradually within himself an alter ego, within his own nature. There gradually arises within him a kind of psychic delusion that all these things are important. The things that are told to him on the outside come back out of him from the inside and begin to support what is actually nothing but a conceit of his own. This being the problem, we face these difficulties in numerous persons who should know better, but who frankly do not wish to be disillusioned. You tell one of these persons that what he is doing is simply self-destructive, and that person will walk out and go on looking until he finds somebody who will agree with him. The person caught in the web of phenomena is usually in a difficult and dangerous position. Now, there are systems by which nearly everything that is important can be gradually known by thoughtful persons. Almost everything that is taught by secret orders that is legitimate can be learned without membership, because these thoughts, these ideals, these principles are available in the basic texts of the original revelations. If you want to understand Hinduism, Buddhism, Zen, if you want to study the Kabbalah, if you want to know more about the Greek mysteries, if you wish to understand the astrology of the Chaldeans or Babylonians, you do not have to join anything to do it. The only thing you have to do is find a competent basic text by one of the original originators of the idea. And you know the great names that are associated with nearly every branch of knowledge. And these great names, as founders, have survived with dignity the test of ages, and you are not likely to get into trouble. You may not agree with them, you don't have to follow them, but if you want to follow a certain line of thought, it is best to follow those who have been best at it and have done the most to develop this particular field of action. Now, it's a very difficult thing in many instances to determine the difference between psychic phenomena and psychological phenomena. This is something that has confounded the ages. And even today, experts have not entirely smoothed out this mystery or this strange parallelism of phenomena. A psychic phenomena can be largely reproduced psychologically. It is, however, not likely that such a psychological procedure will have physical equivalents. But this is not necessarily true. It is quite possible for the psychic energies of the individual, when strongly developed and specialized, can result in physical phenomena. Examples of this, of course, are the table levitations and things of this nature, in which a physical factor is present. The average medium assumes that this physical factor represents another being, an entity from the other side of the veil, that it's another being that produces the phenomena. Actually, there is no reason to question that it can be produced by the individual who is there at the time, by the use and specialization of the psychic energies within himself. It is perfectly possible for a pressure of energy from the invisible part of the person can be precipitated to produce at least a minor physical symptomology or symbolism. So psychological phenomena can include some physical manifestations that have generally been regarded as conclusive of the presence of another being. The psychological phases of phenomena are mostly in the form of internal experiences of one kind or another. They include possessional and obsessional circumstances. Most cases of psychic possession or obsession are psychological. They are not due to the actual presence of another being, but they are due to conditions within the individual himself which have produced a kind of psychic demonology in his own nature. He is presented not with another entity, but with the negative entity of his own personality. The demon in him is the source of his obsession in most instances. Also, we find that dreams, revelations of all kinds, prophetic utterances, oracular demonstrations, all of these things can be psychological. The worst phase of the psychological situation is autohypnosis. The person who has closed their mind to common sense, who has refused constantly to accept realities, but who wishes to live in a world of self-delusion, can gradually defend this position until he is practically impregnable. Nothing can do any further good to that person unless perhaps a very terrible emergency arises. Under this form of self-delusion, you can have all kinds of optical phenomena.